namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om 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 namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Reading this morning from Canto 3, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 26, and the text number is 31. This is continued discussion between Lord Kapila Dev and Devahuti on the title of the chapter, Fundamental Principles of Material Nature. Rather than doing a rewind of all the background, the most recent part of our dialogue, Devahuti asked Lord Kapila Dev to explain the two causal factors, the Supreme Lord and His energies, in relation to the unmanifest and the manifest state of creation. The Lord is a cause, and His energies are also a cause. He's the cause of His energies, and His energies do so many things. So, to respond to that question, the chapter is unfolding. Kapila Dev starts with describing the unmanifest state, what it is, its name, Pradhan, and within Pradhan is everything, because it's the unmanifest, undifferentiated totality of the material energy, and that Pradhan is agitated. Doesn't sound like a nice word, agitated. But Prabhupada doesn't use it in the way that we sometimes use it, that somebody's agitated. It means the use of the word is like creating pregnancy, where the male, to produce pregnancy, agitates the dormant condition of the female, and pregnancy occurs as a result of that agitation. So agitation in this sense is activation, is another word. From a resting, dormant, undifferentiated state to an active, differentiated, producing state. And the agitating agent is his glance. And his glance isn't empty. It's replete with living entities and the time energy. So he quickly describes that the separation of the 24 elements, then he's going to go back and go more slowly and describe how each of the 24 elements unfolds. He identifies a 25th element, time, which isn't material, although it appears to be, because of the consciousness of the living entity, to be material or limited. And 26th element, sometimes described as the living entity. Certainly the living entity is not material. But to have stuff, to have creation, souls are needed, time is needed, the elements are needed. So, with that contact, with the agitation or with the activation of pradhan, then another term is used, mahatattva, and elements start to separate out or appear from mahatattva. The first of them is false ego, and then in contact with the modes of nature, which are inherent in material nature, the modes are there, different other elements separate out, mentioned a few verses previous is mind, false ego, in contact, I'll read this sentence, from false ego of goodness, another transformation takes place, from this evolves the mind, whose thoughts and reflections give rise to desire, or thinking, feeling, willing. And that's an important verse connected to this morning's verse. So the mind is discussed in two verses. The predominating deity of the mind, Aniruddha, is manifest. He's not a material product, but he's manifest to preside over the mind. And if the mind agrees to be presided over by Aniruddha, then the mind remains clear and pure, and one is then in contact with Vasudeva consciousness, because that was also presented earlier, that really early in the stage of unfolding of the elements, Vasudeva, pure consciousness, is present. The soul in pure consciousness doesn't give how much increments of time are there where pure consciousness exists before material contact contaminates. But pure consciousness exists, and if the mind fixes itself or is fixed upon Aniruddha, the Supreme Lord, the Lord of the mind, pure consciousness is restored or maintained. So in this morning's verse, we're going to find out what happens when the mind doesn't do that. And what the mind does, what the option that the mind can be fixed. Following the production of the mind from false ego comes material intelligence. By transformation of the false ego in passion. Now that sounds like false ego transforms in contact with passion. Other places it sounds like the element of material intelligence is there, which manifests when false ego contacts the mode of passion. Either way, I mean, it seems important, but either way that it's expressed, intelligence appears when false ego is in contact with the mode of passion. And then false ego has, or excuse me, material intelligence has a role. Ascertaining or discriminating and helping the senses, and senses have yet to appear, but that's coming attractions. And that's this morning's verse. Egoism in the mode of passion produces two kinds of senses. This is text 31. Here's the two. The senses for acquiring knowledge and the senses of action. The senses of action depend on the vital energy, and the senses for acquiring knowledge depend on intelligence. So later in the purport, Prabhupada explains or declares that since vital energy or life energy is required for operating the knowledge acquiring senses, it is also produced, vital energy is also produced by egoism in the mode of passion. So this is different than, but related to, the animating factor of the soul. The soul is always active, but the soul acts through different faculties or facilities, just like the soul is cognizant, Satchidananda. But that cognizance acts through the subtle body, false ego-minded intelligence. So also the soul is active by nature, but it acts through the agency of this vital energy or life energy. Just like in the King Paranjana story, the serpent, forget it, the serpent's name. Something. And when the king, the serpent is coming to get him, it's the life energy is expiring. And life energy is needed, the prana or life energy is needed to sustain the body. And if prana leaves, means the soul also leaves, and life, the body is unfit for habitation, and the soul leaves. Do we need life air? The soul isn't dependent upon the life air. The bodily sustenance is dependent upon the life air to operate the working senses or the senses of action. The verse says, the senses of action depend on vital energy. So since the senses of action depend on vital energy, and the senses of action are produced by false ego in contact with passion, so that's another product, byproduct of egoism in the mode of passion. It produces the vital energy. Again, produces, it's not the chemical evolution theory, or it's already there within Pradhana, the element is manifest in order to sustain life. Here's the intelligence. Here's the two kinds of senses. So one intelligence supports the knowledge acquiring, life air supports the working senses. That's the picture. Purport. It has been explained in the previous verses, plural, because this is intelligence, previous verses was the mind. It has been explained in the previous verses that mind is the product of ego and goodness, and that the function of the mind is acceptance and rejection according to desire. So, in verse 27, desire is explained, and desire is preceded by thinking and feeling. Or, translated a little differently, thoughts and reflections give rise to desire. Thoughts take place within the mind, feelings take place within the mind, desire takes place within the mind. But desire is the byproduct of the mind. So, according to desire, then comes another function of the mind that's an appropriate way to describe what does the mind do, accepting, rejecting, sankalpa, vikalpa. And sankalpa, I just heard this yesterday, Prabhupada was using the definition of sankalpa as determination. Like, when we have our japa retreats, we have a little sankalpa exercise. So, what is that desire or the purpose which is wished to be fulfilled. And if the mind can become fixed in that way, that's sankalpa. So there's the flip side, because mind is a binary function. It's if you accept this, you reject that. If you reject that, you have to accept something. So in this paragraph, the first paragraph of the purport, Prabhupada is discussing desire. Little review, where does desire arise from? It's not explicitly stated in the purport, it's indirectly stated that desire is of the soul. You can't become desireless in the absolute sense, but when Vedas or spiritual teachings speak of desirelessness, it's not voidness, but no material desire. No material desire means no desire separate from Krishna. So desire in relation to Krishna is what's advocated. So soul desire originates in the soul, but at the same time we can correctly, as verse 27 says, attribute desire to the mind. But the mind, you don't even get a mind without the soul having separate desire from Krishna. You don't get a material mind. There's a spiritual mind, and it goes to Krishna or Aniruddha. So desire arises, or it is within the soul. When the soul is in contact with matter, it acquires a mind. And according to the contemplations of the mind, desire arises, as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita. By contemplating, that's a mind function. When contemplating objects of the senses, that's done through the agency of the knowledge-acquiring senses. When contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops some attachment for them. Feeling. And then willing, I want or I don't want. It can be either way. I like, I don't like. It's pleasing, it's not pleasing. But it's still a mental function. And then, according to desire, we accept and reject. That's the first sentence of the purport. But here, intelligence is said to be the product of ego and passion. That is the distinction between the mind and intelligence. Semicolon. Mind is a product of egoism and goodness, and intelligence is a product of egoism and passion. The desire to accept something and reject something is a very important factor of the mind, since the mind is a product of the mode of passion, a mode of goodness. If it is fixed on the Lord of the mind, Aniruddha, then the mind can be changed to Krishna consciousness. And then comes this: the desire is within the soul, stated indirectly. It is stated by Narottam Das Thakur that we always have desires. Desires cannot be stopped. Then the two options: if we transfer our desire to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that is the perfect life. As soon as the desire as transferred to lording it over material nature, it becomes contaminated by matter. Accepting, rejecting, meant to be guided by intelligence. That's when things are in proper order. The intelligence directs the mind. Go here and don't go there. And that's the mind. Then there's the intelligence that has its knowledge acquiring senses, working senses, that's when things are in proper order, it's ruled by the mind. And when it's not in proper order, it's the other way around. They dictate to the mind dictates to the intelligence, and things are upside down. So given these two options, if this and if that, and two different outcomes, desire has to be purified for spiritual life. And then how? In the beginning, this purification process has to be carried out by the order of the spiritual master, since the spiritual master knows how the disciple's desire can be transformed into Krishna consciousness. Desire transformed into Krishna consciousness. Now there's three different things that have been said in this little section. Mind in Krishna consciousness, the intelligence in Krishna consciousness, and consciousness in Krishna consciousness. It's a pure state of the mind, a pure state of intelligence, and a pure state of consciousness. And they're all part of Krishna consciousness when things are in proper order. As far as intelligence is concerned, it is clearly stated here that it is a product of egoism in passion. So he just described how the mind can become transformed into Krishna consciousness. Now here's intelligence. By practice, one comes to the point of the mode of goodness. We may not be in the mode of goodness, but by practice, by right means, automatically, it's the mode of goodness. Just regulation is the mode of goodness, symptomatic of the mode of goodness. And when following it properly, the mode of goodness becomes established. And remember that the mind is a product of the mode of goodness, so then it becomes more easy, or easier, for the mind to go to Aniruddha or Krishna or the Personality of Godhead, contemplate then feelings and then desires, so restoring desires within the mind side of things. Then, by surrendering or fixing the mind upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one becomes a very great personality or Mahatma. In Bhagavad Gita, it is clearly said, sa mahatma sa durlabha. Such a great soul is very rare. It sounded easy till that last part. The path was there. But the willingness to go that path, that's another thing. Willingness, that's desire. So, what we allow the mind to contemplate is very important. And that we take intelligence, as the purport is saying, starting with the orders of the spiritual master, as we accept that intelligence. Through the orders come as intelligence guiding the mind, and the senses, and working senses, knowledge acquiring senses, at least in the beginning stage to the quality of goodness, and then the contemplation of the real purpose, the personality of Godhead, and the desire to attain Him. Just as Krishna says in the 12th chapter, by following the regulations of Bhakti Yoga, one develops the desire to attain to me. So the initial mode of goodness position is, I wish purification. And I regulate according to the regulations of Bhakti Yoga for purification. And in that purified state, the desire to attain Krishna becomes gradually stronger and then the mind becomes fully purified or Krishna conscious. The intelligence is then given, like when Krishna sees someone very sincerely striving in that way, he gives this buddhi yoga, the dhammi buddhi yoga from hina mahupiyanti, so they can come to him. Not just motive goodness, but come to him. Next paragraph. In this verse, it is clear that both kinds of senses, the senses for acquiring knowledge and the senses for action, are products of egoism in the mode of passion. And because the sense organs for activity and for acquiring knowledge require energy, the vital energy or life energy is also produced by egoism in the mode of passion. The rest of the paragraph, which is the rest of the purport, Prabhupada is comparing the life of a person in the quality of goodness, a saintly person, and contrasting with the life of a passionate person or a very materially active, productive person. And how the results are different. Results are different in more than one way. I'll say it and then read it. One of the ways that there's difference is the person in the mode of passion, whose intelligence is fired up in the mode of passion, very easily and quickly they can produce things and get things, objects from their activity. And their vital energy is very strong in that direction. And that looks like prosperity. Yeah. And in contrast, the person in the quality of goodness, that passion factor is less. They don't have the same inspiration to go get things and to acquire things. They have a different aspiration. And so it looks like this one is successful and that one's not successful. This one is rich and that one is poor. And Prabhupada says, however, the person who has no taste for Krishna consciousness, they're poor. So someone might think, okay, let me see if I can get both. So here's the explanation. We can actually see, therefore, that those who are very passionate and can improve in material acquisition very quickly. It is recommended in the Vedic scriptures that if one wants to encourage a person in acquiring material possessions, one should also encourage him in sex life. We naturally find that those who are addicted to sex life are also materially advanced because sex life or passionate life is the impetus for material advancement of civilization. Contrastingly, for those who want to make spiritual advancement, there is almost no existence of the mode of passion. Only the mode of goodness is prominent. Then there's the devotees. We find that those who engage in Krishna consciousness are materially poor. Not always. But one who has eyes can see who is greater. Although he appears to be materially poor, a person in Krishna consciousness is not actually a poor man, but the person who has no taste for Krishna consciousness and appears to be very happy with material possessions is actually poor. Poor by material standard. Or, he doesn't say it here, the wealth of the brahmana is his austerity, which sounds like a contradiction, because if you're doing austerity, it means you're doing without things. If you're doing without things, how's that wealth? But the capacity that arises when one does without things, it's another wealth. Another wealth besides the wealth of detachment, or the opulence of detachment. Strength. The strength of detachment, and the strength of attachment, and in things in between. The determination to stay the course of spiritual practice comes from austerity. Prabhupada was asked, how does one increase determination? And his answer was by performance of austerities. Not artificial or whimsical conjectured austerities, but the austerity of observing regulation is an austerity, or observing various vratas on holy days, fasting on holy days, observing Kartik vrata, we just passed, some, and staying the course, observing it in a determined manner. By that kind of determination, it strengthens one's all-around capacity for determination. It gives one spiritual strength. So, austerity is the wealth of the brahmanas, or the one who is following the restrictions, the tapasya, like that verse from the sixth canto, first chapter, Bhagavatam. Tapasya brahmacharyena. The first principle of transcendental life is tapasya. Tapo divyam bhutapriyena sattvam shudyat, in Rishabhdev's teachings. First principle. If one wants to become human and elevated in consciousness by culture, then you leave the animal platform and you go to the human platform. And the animal platform doesn't have regulation, and the human platform has regulation. That regulation, when you're in the mode of passion or ignorance, it may look like painful. And it's not. It's nice. But initially it may seem painful. Prabhupada gives the example of the person who is addicted to cigarette smoking. And to give up cigarette smoking is very painful. But actually, cigarette smoking is painful. And giving up cigarette smoking is nice. And so forth. Not just something that's overtly, even the AMA says it's nasty, but so many other things that are, as far as the soul concerned, nasty, harmful, debilitating, bad for your health, bad for your mind, bad for the soul, bad. And to give it up, oh, that's too much. Impossible. To the materialist, that looks like austerity. To the devotee, it's a wealth. It's a detachment from sinful life. Attachment to mode of goodness. Leading it to transcendence. It's just a modes of nature issue, initially. Or a human existence versus animal existence issue. In explaining the jivo jivasya jivanam verse, ahastani sahastanam, maybe it's the other way around, sahastani ahastanam, those animals would have no hands, are food for those who have animals that have hands. What are animals that have hands?
Humans
that are like animals. So if you're an animal that has hands, then animals become your food, animals with no hands. But if you're a human that has hands, then animals are not your food. Then you're in human form of life, and that's regulation or austerity. You don't do that. The intelligence is given by scripture and you're guided by scripture. So initially it brings one to the mode of goodness. Even just unoffered, non-meat-eating way of life helps. It's not sufficient, it just brings one to the human stage. Beginning human stage. Last part of the paragraph in purport. Persons infatuated by material consciousness are very intelligent in discovering things for material comforts, but they have no access to understanding the spirit soul and spiritual life. Therefore, if anyone wants to advance in spiritual life, he has to come back to the platform of purified desire. What is that? The purified desire for devotional service. As stated in the Narada Pancharatra, engagement in the service of the Lord, where the senses are purified in Krishna consciousness, is called pure devotion. It's very beautifully done how Srila Prabhupada is taking this very technical subject matter and bringing it to devotional service. But that's what it's meant for, actually. Why is the personality of Godhead, Lord Kapiladeva, interested at all in just material analysis? He's not interested in just material analysis. How do you apply that, the fruit of that analysis, for beneficial means? The purport has helped us do that. What's the relationship between the mind and the intelligence and the knowledge acquiring and the working senses and desire? And if properly applied, it brings one to one's original Krishna consciousness. And by default, if one doesn't have proper knowledge, proper understanding, one can easily, as in the default position, just fall into material consciousness and think under illusion of the influence of the illusory energy. This is advancement. This is success. This is the standard of success. Get things. Acquire things. Make new things that bring some sensation to the craving of the senses, knowledge or working senses. That's success. And Kapila Davis helping Devahuti understand, because going way back, she's asked Kapila Dev to extract her from her attachments to the bodily conception of life. That's pretty basic. And with the bodily conception of life, the sense of identifying self with mind, I and mind, particularly Karnama Muni and her son Kapila Dev. Karnamuni's already gone and Kapila Dev's in front of her, but she understands This is the personality of God. It is not my son. So not mine. He's not my son. But I have these emotions, and I'm attached to these emotions, and my mind is bewildered. My intelligence is reeling. What to do? Please help me. So that's, he's helping her to see the difference between material consciousness and the preferred alternative, spiritual consciousness. That's what she wants. And he's providing the means. Okay. And there, see if there's some discussion. Is there?
I find my own life that because of working for a particular kind of company where everything is just very much passion driven and very much the points that you have mentioned, that like tendency to produce things quickly and then tendency to perform, all those things are very much dominant, and it's kind of also surcharged by the atmosphere that is already pervading in the company. So when I hear that like, I should move in the direction of framing the life in the mode of goodness, is it that like I
feel I'm in the wrong place?
Slow down, or like is that the direction to take, or just having the purpose, overall purpose in mind that okay, I'm supposed to purify. And
it depends on the level of consciousness that one has developed. So an entry level of consciousness is rather than be caught up in the passionate mode, let me contemplate this is a means to maintain my family, and I'll use this means to maintain my family and offer the fruits to Krishna. That's a beginning. Then looking beyond that, to get to the place where I am right now, it's guna and karma. I am where I am in part as a product of past activity and my association with the modes of nature. I have a certain nature that's placed me where I am. And I can't just hit the reset button and it's gone. It's a nature. So, given the first soundbite, family, responsibility, offer the fruits to Krishna, I have my nature. Now what do I do to go further in Krishna consciousness? Because there's this, as you described, this wave of passion-driven atmosphere. So if it... what's essential is, minimally, trying to fix the mind on another purpose besides compete, perform, win success so I can keep my job and get that bonus and climb the corporate ladder and whatever else, the perks that people, that keep people working hard. Strive for another purpose. Some of those other purposes could be Krishna has placed me here in this workplace because I can serve, or by being here I can serve Krishna in elevating the consciousness of the persons in the workplace. That's a challenge. But how to do that is by carrying Krishna consciousness in the workplace. So the way that I conduct myself, performance for a different purpose than the bonus or maintaining my livelihood or getting recognition or those kinds of perks, having people in the workplace respect this is a spiritual person, and spiritual persons can also be productive. And not only spiritual person, but a Krishna Bhakta. So their respect for Krishna and Krishna Bhakti can be elevated just by my example in the workplace. Being productive for that purpose. Appreciation goes to Krishna. And Krishna Bhakti. You're a representative, so appreciation may go to you, but it's not for me, it's service to Krishna. And then other choices that one can make in the workplace. Responding to pressure. How does a devotee respond to pressure compared to a non-devotee respond to pressure? How does a devotee deal with when there's a mistake? What does the devotee busy himself like the others do of faulting the other parties and backbiting? And the devotee doesn't do that. What does the devotee do? Doesn't waste energy doing those things. The devotee is way ahead of the others because he's thinking of solutions and Krishna's inspiring and so forth. And then not only, you know, the chief, the big cheese, looks at that worker saying, he's a good worker. But the others understand, here's somebody that's different from the rest of us. They just consistently don't respond like we respond. They don't indulge themselves in this. Now, some persons may, this is one of the common sound bites that says, the other workers take advantage of that person that's docile and doesn't, you know, do the combat in the workplace. That's, you know, I say that's their problem. If they think that's the path of success, come a step on your head because you're docile, that's their problem, not our problem. You continue to perform in a Krishna conscious way, and that person is trying to step on your head, everyone will understand what that person is. How they deal with that person is another thing, but you know, that's their business. Your business is to serve Krishna. Anyway, maybe this, that, or the other thing can be done to deal with that person, but you go on, minimally, you go on with just working for Krishna. Maybe be a Prahlad Maharaj in the midst of little Hiranyakashipus. And over a period of time, some persons in the workplace are going to have some problems. Problems with their career, problems with their family, problems with their mind, problems with their life. And here's this spiritual personality in our midst, and they'll come and share that. And there'll be an opportunity to talk spiritual subject matters other than just the performance kind of subject matters or all the other, you know, sports and politics and the other things that people talk about in the workplace. Some people will speak about spiritual topics. So that's a service. And it's an austere service. But it's a service that you can do for Krishna in the workplace. That a brahmachari or sannyasi isn't going to be able to do. It's not an all expansive service. It's confined to the people in the workplace, at least for that period of time that you're in the workplace. But then it can build, if it's done properly, build a discipline that then outside of the workplace can be shared with other people that are having the same challenges as you're having in the workplace. You can share your Krishna consciousness and how to negotiate or navigate through life when it has its similar complexities for other people and other spheres. So rather than a teaching that's abstract and doesn't have examples, be an example. And then you can speak from that position. and help and guide other people from that position. Because supposing you said, you know, you did something else. Let me stop doing this. And then the message may be, and maybe for some people that's appropriate, but the message may be, my dear friend, you're interested in Krishna consciousness? Here's the program. Get rid of your job and come over here and, you know, do something that's in the mode of goodness. That model is not a model people can relate to. So there may be some that's good for them to do. Have that example, but this is another example. And it serves as a model. Even if it's not people that you're directly in the workplace or outside the workplace dealing with, just as an example of how to. And if our society of Sangha of devotees have a number of such nice examples, it instructs people that it works. You can be not influenced by that passionate mode and be Krishna conscious in that atmosphere. It's doable. For someone that at some point in time comes along and contacts Krishna consciousness, and they already have all their things set up, their job and their family and their home and their responsibilities, and then Krishna consciousness comes into their life. How am I supposed to do this? There's examples how you do it. So it's a service. A service that has its austerities. But life has its austerities. This, cut it this way or that way or the other way, there's austerity. So that's a particular set of austerities. Now, it could certainly be, for me, it is best to move to some situation, you know, where you can fight your war with Maya best. If that model that I just described is something that can inspire and at the same time facilitates, I can move about and I have resource to serve Krishna in other ways that I wouldn't, that would be diminished if I didn't have that resource. So it's where you want it, where you're best at serving Krishna.
Guruji, what is the function of a presiding deity? Like, I've heard this sometimes, the demigods are presiding deities of the various senses and so on and so forth. What does it really mean?
If demigods are presiding deities of something, they have a presiding deity. The Supreme Lord is their presiding deity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, in describing, it's right in the chapter, this is text 21 purport, where Vasudev, Vasudev consciousness, or Vasudev is manifest through contact with the mode of goodness, then, so Vasudev presides over consciousness and the state of pure consciousness. One is conscious of Krishna. So worship of Vasudev assists in achieving Vasudev consciousness.
So
then in the purport, there's Sankarshan, who's presides over false ego. And if one wants to become free from false ego, one worships Sankarshan. And to assist that, one may worship Lord Shiva, who worships Lord Sankarshan. So there's a presiding deity, Sankarshan. But Lord Shiva has some role there also, or the presiding in the mode of goodness. Aniruddha. And worship of Aniruddha is assisted, I'll read the exact language. If one wants to get free from mental disturbances, one has to worship Aniruddha. For that purpose, worship of the moon planet is also recommended in Vedic literature. So the moon is the presiding deity of the mind, but the presiding deity of the moon is Aniruddha. So as the moon or Chandra worships Aniruddha, we can worship Aniruddha. If one has a better understanding, worship of the moon for a more peaceful state of mind, behind that is Aniruddha. And then Pradyumna. Similarly, to be fixed in one's intelligence, one has to worship Pradyumna, who is reached through the worship of Brahma. So, if there is not Vaishnava understanding, then one becomes a demigod worshipper, or may become a demigod worshipper, thinking, oh, this demigod is going to help me in this department, that department. Or there's a presiding deity of this department, let me worship that presiding deity. But above the presiding deity is the Supreme Lord. And in various manifestations. At least with these primary mind, intelligence, false ego, and consciousness. And then subdivisions of those. False ego in touch with passion produces knowledge of firing and working senses. So, presiding deity of this working sense, that working sense, one can worship.
So their function is to grant a blessing or benediction.
From which the power for which is being derived from the Supreme Lord. So Vaishnava understands that we simply worship the Supreme Lord. Mm-hmm. And not disrespect, but worship the Supreme Lord. Yes?
Two questions. One is from yesterday's class. You're giving the example of Bhishma Dev. My understanding is that all of the spiritual master stands higher to the religious principles. So here Bhishma Dev is wanting to follow his vow, but his, I guess his spiritual master partially understands.
Yes, specifically, he says to Parashuram, according to the Vedas, there are three conditions under which the order of the spiritual master position is to be rejected. He lists them in the details, I can't remember exactly right now. But one of them is where the instruction of the spiritual master is specifically against an injunction of the Vedas, because the spiritual master is to represent the Vedas. That's the strength and the empowerment of the spiritual master. He instructs something that's against the Vedas to be neglected, so I'm pointing neglect. But you're given this other option, so let's do the other option. Because the instruction was either this or that. Not that one, this one. It's something like the four Kumaras saying no to Lord Brahma to become married and produce children. Whereas the Prachetas, being instructed by their father the same way, it was yes. And they were honored for their obedience to the instruction of their father. But they were inclined, and four Kumaras were not inclined. And Prabhupada writes in that connection, that's one instruction that can be bypassed. If the instruction is you should get married, it's okay. And so that's an instruction that can be set aside under the authority of the Vedas.
pretty much a follow-up. So when the instruction comes, my understanding is that usually it's a conversation before we say whether it's possible to do or, you know, we can follow it or not. But like when we hear examples where, like, we say not this person, master, and do something else,
I'm not sure what your question is, but my thoughts went to Bhaktisiddhanta instructing Srila Prabhupada to go to the West. I was hearing Prabhupada describe a group of students, his friend. They said no, they said yes, and so they went. And it was not just him alone, it was a group of students that came. And immediately, you're educated young men. You take this message of Lord Chaitanya, so an instruction. And Prabhupada didn't do it right away, but he carried the instruction, understanding that he should do it. But how can I do it? And then the instruction came again. He understood he needed to do it, and he was preparing and still feeling unqualified. And then we have a Sayatnika Buddhi purporter, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Yes, I must do it. Feeling unqualified. Well, you carry the instruction even if you're unable or feeling oneself unable to perform. The instruction is an instruction. You prepare yourself to execute it. That's an example the Prabhupada gave of himself. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
From today's class, just like there is this hierarchy from sense objects, mind, intelligence, and consciousness, does the purification also happen the other way?
From Madhurya Kandambini, my understanding is, for Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, it happens differently.
Mm-hmm.
For different individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, it's pervasive. So something may happen first over here or first over there, depending upon an individual.
Mm-hmm. Specifically, I was wondering the situations where, like, we are taken over by the push and pulls of the mind, and when the intelligence is not able to guide the mind, I feel more encouraged when the intelligence is strengthened, say, by hearing or engaging the intelligence in some services versus trying to control the mind. I thought purify my intelligence.
Well, and then in that case, that's fine. Then in that case, you do what Krishna says, which is one who studies this sacred conversation is worshipping me with their intelligence.
Mm.
So strengthen intelligence. At the same time, chaita darpana marjanam, that's cleansing the mirror of the mind. So it's a quick parallel process.
Mm-hmm.
Chanting purify the mind and heart, and intelligence becoming strengthened and sharpened and energized.
Mm-hmm. But if someone is too much attached to results, because we see results when we purify the intelligence.
Then you go to this, like, very beginning instruction, you tolerate. Don't pay so much attention to the mind that's pushing.
Mm-hmm.
You tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, your consciousness becomes somewhat more freed to invest in transcendence.
Mm.
Scripture, hearing, chanting, deity worship. And while doing those things, the mind may be hammering, and you tolerate it.
Mm.
Don't go there and say, oh, my dear mind, what's important for you over here? Yeah, let me tell you all about it. Oh, really? just tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
And invest consciousness in spirit, shuddha. And gradually that purification will follow, where the voice diminishes and it's just, it's contact with the modes of nature, specifically the mode of passion or the mode of ignorance if it's troubling. But recognizing that in principle, withdraw from that mode and direct the intelligence, so that eventually the intelligence can say to the mind, look, this is just Maya. So it's a little bit like this very nice short section. We find that those who engage in Krishna consciousness are materially poor. But one who has eyes can see who is greater. Although he appears to be materially poor, a person in Krishna consciousness is not actually a poor man. But the person who has no taste for Krishna consciousness and appears to be very happy with material possessions is actually poor. So, okay, that's a nice paragraph to read, but what happens when there's a situation where something that the mind says I need or want, and it's not there? So it's the mode of passion interacting with the mind saying, you got to get that thing, or you can't be peaceful. And it keeps gnawing. You got to get that thing, you can't be peaceful. Just keeps gnawing. And eventually you pay attention, thinking, well, you know, I can't even concentrate because I got to take care of this thing. So how is one to come to the stage where, well, wait a minute, that's an unfortunate position. Instead of saying, the fortunate position is one who doesn't have that thing. And is happy not having that thing. That's the fortunate position. But one can't see that when the modes are active and the mind is paying attention to the modes of nature. So it's an opulence to be detached. It's not ignorance, or it's not misfortune. It's an opulence. And then in any circumstance, have or not have, one can be peaceful. And when that opulence is missing, have or not have, one is not peaceful. So to get that wealth and to have the realization as you're moving along the path of life and seeing how other people are doing things, it has nothing to do with how other people. It has to do with your own relationship with Krishna and being peaceful in whatever the arrangements are that Krishna's making in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And being happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an opulence. It's a great treasure. It's a great wealth. The persons that don't have that, no matter what they have or don't have, they're unsettled. Always uncomfortable. Have or not have, always uncomfortable. Something's not right. I'm not settled. And then the material intelligence with folded palms comes and says, my dear Krishna Priya, what can we do for you? Well, I'm unsettled here, and can you make an arrangement? Oh, yes. This and that, and, you know, still not peaceful. And that's a hard lesson of life to learn, but one who learns that lesson, that's an opulence, that's wealth. Okay. Shri Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.
Srirantha Svarmanaj ki jai.